definitely fascinate anybody. And then I didn't know any more about it because in those days we really didn't have that much contact with India. This is 1967, 68. There was almost no interchange at that time. So I didn't hear anything more about it, but that day it was very, he was telling me all about it. He was going to Allahabad, which is a very holy place, and they have this every 12 years. And he said, I shall take you. Well, I forgot about it. Then in 1976, I went to India with my friend Kusha, and we were in Mumbai with Prabhupada, and I found out it was the year of the Mela. I didn't even know. And it was a very interesting story because this Mela was so big. There were millions of people expected. And there was no way anyone could get in if they didn't have advance reservations for months and months and months in advance. On trains, you know, had arms and legs sticking out. It was just like people on top of the trains, you know how India is. And there was just no way in and no way out to go into this Mela. But Prabhupada was determined to go. He really wanted to go. It's a very important preaching opportunity. So many people tried to talk him out of it. So many godbrothers tried to talk him out of it because his health wasn't good. But he was very determined to go. And interestingly enough, there was a man who became a life member right about that time, a Mr. Gupta. And he just happened by chance to be the head of the Indian Railway. And so what he did was, there was no way into this Mela. He added two cars onto the train. Anybody that's lived in India knows that this is almost impossible. With all the bureaucracy, he actually added a first-class car and a second-class car. He even had the cars painted, freshly painted, and Prabhupada's compartment had strings of garlands hanging. And also he sent, Mr. Gupta sent his personal servant along, you know, his manservant along to, just in case Prabhupada needed something. So my girlfriend Kusha and I happened to be in Mumbai at that time, and we were traveling with a three-year-old, her son, and all of a sudden I found myself going to the Mela, which was an impossibility. But actually what happened, we gave our money to Mr. Gupta, and he arranged for us to have a first-class coupe right next to Prabhupada's coupe. And then, as we were leaving, I remembered what he said, what he had told me years before, I shall take you to the Mela. This is an example of the Vak Siddhi. When someone speaks something, it has to come true. So we went into the Mela, and Prabhupada was in the coupe right next to us, and me and my girlfriend Kusha and her three-year-old Atmarama were in the coupe. Well, we went back and forth. Prabhupada was in four berths. We had the two, and he had some sannyasis with him, and like I said, there were flowers strung, and we brought him grapes, and we brought him mangoes, and we brought him all kinds. We would send Atmar, the three-year-old, in to bring him things, and we went into the Mela, and because Allahabad train station was so, it was very, very dangerous. In fact, that morning when we left Mumbai, the train station in Bombay, Kusha and I arrived at the train station, and Prabhupada was there alone with Rameshwar. And the devotees hadn't gotten there yet. This is just before we're departing. And it was a madhouse. I mean, when these melas take place, you've probably heard about them. People get trampled, and, you know, you've heard about these incredible, they're very heavy duty. And so it was really funny that morning. Prabhupada was standing there, and there were all these coolies going by with trunks, and it was a madhouse. And I was afraid he was going to get bumped. So Rameshwar remembers this too. I told him, reminded him of it last time. So for an Indian, I'm rather tall. And so I stood with my arms out like this, and I told Rameshwar, put your danda out. He put his danda out. He was a sannyasi at that time. He put his danda out, and I had my arms out, and we had Prabhupada between us so that nobody could bump him with the trunks. It was such a madhouse. So when we got to Allahabad, Allahabad would have been worse because so many people, millions of people flowing in from all over India. So Mr. Gupta arranged for that train to stop in the Rajasthani desert before it arrived in the Allahabad station. Here we are, it's the middle of the night, we stop in the middle of the night, in the dark, in the desert, and Hansa Dutta had some buses that met us in the desert, and so we got off the train, Prabhupada got off the train and into his car without ever having to go into the Allahabad train station. I mean, if you know anything about India, you know that this is almost nothing short of a miracle, because getting anything done there for Sarvara's travel is virtually impossible. But like I said, Mr. Gupta, by chance, had just become a life member a couple of months before. So then we were at the Mela for several days. Prabhupada was not very happy with the situation. There were a lot of problems. He didn't like the location. The location they had given us wasn't good. And there were a lot of problems, that some of which I didn't know about, some of which I did. But in any case, Prabhupada's health wasn't so good there. So Kusha and I went and talked to Mr. Gupta because Prabhupada was asking for cow's milk. And I mean, you're doing good to get food at the Mela. So Mr. Gupta immediately shipped a cow from Bombay into the Mela. And so he had his own milk cow right there in the Mela. So he had fresh milk. Mr. Gupta was a wonderful man. And so we were there for several days, and Prabhupada had fresh milk. And then Palika was cooking for him at that time. And then the way we left, interestingly enough, Mr. Gupta arranged for the same situation, that the train, that we would meet the train in the on the other side going toward, we'd be going toward Calcutta and Mayapur, and so we would be boarding the train also in the desert in the dead of night, or I don't remember exactly what time of day it was. I remember when we got there it was the dead of night, or wee hours in the morning. But then we went on, and one thing which we had some sannyasis. Prabhupada was really critical of the sannyasis at that time. I was behind a tent flap, and he was yelling at them, "This is not sannyas. This is not the meaning of sannyas." And some of the sannyasis wanted us to be left at the Mela. In other words, we didn't want the women and children in that coupe. And Prabhupada said, "The women and children stay." Because if we were left at the Mela, that's just, it's a very, very rugged experience. I mean, you're sleeping on straw in the middle of the desert. Now it's probably better, but in those days, it was extremely austere. It would have been very dangerous for the child's health, especially. So we went on from there to Calcutta. And then from Calcutta, Prabhupada went to Mayapur. But at some point, we went down to Bhubaneswar. In Bhubaneswar and Puri. And that's when Prabhupada gave his famous Puri address, which was probably the most incredible lecture I had ever heard him give. It was, I'm sure you're all familiar with his famous Puri address. I'm sure it was recorded. You're familiar with it, right, Adide? Yeah. Where he told the pandas that Lord Jagannath could pack up and move. Yeah, I mean, he really... Well, see, Kusha and I went down to Puri, and Prabhupada was in Bhubaneswar, which is a short bus ride from Puri. I should probably end this question, otherwise I'll just get distracted with all these things, and who wants to hear all this? No? Okay, I'll finish. Okay, so Kusha and I had been going down to Puri because she's extremely fond of Lord Jagannath, and we got prasadam, and we brought some back to Srila Prabhupada. We got some of those puris that they give you. And I asked Srila Prabhupada, is it okay if I go in the Jagannath temple? And he said, okay. He said, it's okay. So I thought, well, I'll give it a shot. Well, I'm really much too tall for an Indian, and I'm also don't know how to walk properly because they have a certain walk. So naturally, they stopped me, and naturally, they ripped my charger off, and naturally, they beat me. And so I didn't have the best feelings about Puri after that. But when Prabhupada found out about it, he was extremely unhappy that they did not let his disciples into Jagannath temple. And so he was invited, but he was very famous now. Prabhupada was extremely famous now all over India. So one of the pandas, the pandas, they're like the priests and priestly class in Puri, had written a book, and they wanted Prabhupada to present the book, because it, you know, just like you get a book review and you have a famous person present the book. So we all went down to Puri, and actually Kusha and I were already there. I mean, we were taking a rickshaw to the place where he was going to speak. And it was a place on the beach. I still don't know exactly where it is, but anybody who's from Puri would know where it is. It was next to near a Gaudiya Math temple, and they had erected like a panda, what do they call them, pandals? So they had erected this big platform outdoors by the ocean, and there were all of the important people of Puri there, the people who run the town, that run the Jagannath temple. And Prabhupada was kind of like the guest of honor, because he was going to introduce this book that had just been written. I remember the invitation was printed in red ink, and it had Jagannath and Subhadra. It had a picture of them. So whatever the book was about, it was in another language, but it was about something to do with Jagannath. So Prabhupada got up there, and he started talking about how Lord Chaitanya never approved of this, keeping people out of the temple, seeing the Lord. And that he appeals to these pundits. He appeals to them. He says, I request you, please. They have come so far. They have come from halfway around the world. Please let them come in to see the Lord. And then his lecture got a little bit more intense. He started to explain that Jagannath is not Ketanath, Jagannath is not Purinath, Jagannath is Jagannath. He's the Lord of the universe. So he's not just your Jagannath, he's for everyone. So you should allow them to come and see him. And then he said, Jagannath does not have to stay. Jagannath can pack up and leave. He spoke an incredibly heavy lecture. And of course, they did have a meeting the next day, I heard, and they voted against against letting the devotees go in. But what was so amazing to me was after he said all this, then one of these guys came over and handed him the book and pointed to the book so that he could, you know, supposed to say something about the book. And he looked at the book and he said, oh, I do not know. And he got up and walked off the stage. And there was like this whole flock of Western devotees following him. And he walked to the nearest Gaudiya Mutt. It was nearby. I don't know which one it was because I haven't been there since. But there was an incredible kirtan. And I remember it was so incredible. It was the most incredible kirtan I had ever been to. I told Kusha, if there's any heaven higher than this, I don't think so. And Atmaram, her little boy, was jumping up and down and dancing, and Prabhupada was sitting in the chair in front of the deities. And there was like a whole crowd of Western devotees. And then everyone left, because Prabhupada had his car there with the little flags, the maroon car with the flags, with a brass plate. It was, I don't know, I always found that kind of exciting, seeing that brass, his name engraved on the brass plate, and these two flags. It was exciting. And so then the brahmacharis or whoever ran that temple asked us, who is that? They didn't know, who is that? So anyway, what is it? Did Srila Prabhupada give you instructions for deity worship? If so, can you tell about it? And can you tell us how you brought Tulsi to America? Yes, he gave many instructions on deity worship, especially because we had Panchatattva deities in Hawaii. And it's too cold. And so he gave us very specific instructions on how to worship Panchatattva. And in general, also instructions so far as worshiping all the deities, but there were a lot of specific ones for Panchatattva. And one of the things that he said so far as deity worship is concerned, he taught that you offer everything. For example, if you get a new cloth that not somebody gives you, but that's brand new, you offer that also. You offer that to Krishna. Or if you have, of course, prasadam, you offer. And the mood of offering is that first you offer to your guru, and then he offers to his guru, and up through the disciplic succession, up to Krishna. Because we don't really have a right to approach Krishna directly. And so we don't directly offer to Radhanath. Actually, this is something I wrote down, that he actually spoke this. The process is that whatever we offer to the deity, that is offered first to the guru, and then the guru offers to his guru. In this way, it goes to Krishna. We don't directly offer to Radha Krishna. No, we have no right. Neither he accepts in that way. The pictures of the acharyas, why they're there. Actually, one has to offer the plate to his guru, and he'll offer it to his guru. He offers to his guru, and he offers to his guru. In this way, it will go to Krishna. That is the process. You cannot directly approach Krishna or other subordinates to Krishna. That is not possible. So one time I brought him a sweater in L.A., and I had just bought it at the market. It was a perfect color of saffron, which is really hard to find. And so he immediately took off his sweater, which was a golden yellow mustard color sweater, and he handed it to me. And then he just put on the brand new sweater. And I said, well, I haven't washed it yet. You know, I thought I should wash it before, you know, it came from the store. And he said, oh, no, it is purified by your purchase of it. So that was one thing I remember. And he explained that the acharya acts as our advocate. An advocate in India is a lawyer. Here you would call it a mediator, I think, you know. And he acts as our advocate that, oh, please, this person has offered this to you. Please accept it. And so what happens is, Krishna, it's not very likely that we can approach, Prabhupada said we can't approach directly, but if his pure devotee, if Srila Prabhupada approaches them, oh, this girl, she's not so smart, she's not so good, but she's very sincere, so please accept this offering that she has given. So it's kind of like that. That's one of the main things. Oh, my dear Lord, please accept this, whatever. And so Krishna can't refuse his pure devotee. The fact is we're all riding on Prabhupada's coattails. That's what it boils down to. So far as deity worship, people write me sometimes and ask, should there be three circles here or five circles here or four circles here? And I'm like, ooh. I know that generally speaking there's seven circles. But I think the intention is very important, just like we first offer to Srila Prabhupada and to Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, and then we offer to Gaurini Thai, or if we're worshiping Panchatattva, we offer in the order of the, you know, we offer in the proper order, always going upward, never going top and then coming down. And so that's one thing. And so far as Lord Chaitanya, I remember him saying how the devotees don't like to see him. It's very painful for the devotees to see the Lord as a sannyasi because he's the Lord. And so they always worship him as a householder, but not as a renunciate, because that's very painful for the devotees. So he has always worshipped in temples with his associates, dancing mood, or standing in kirtan with the rest of the Panchatattva or with Lord Nityananda. But there's tons of more stuff about deity worship. I don't want to get into a super detail, but there's a lot more stuff. And so far as bringing Tulsi, I think that was the second question. Actually, Srila Prabhupada arranged all of that. So far as the bringing Tulsi to America, from the very beginning, I wanted some Tulsi beads, and they weren't available in New York. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of the beads that we were initiated with back in 1967. They were about this big around, and you could literally knock somebody out with your bead bag, you know. I mean, these huge wooden red beads. And I didn't like those very much. They were kind of heavy. But I still have them. I still have those wooden beads. But they're kind of clunky. And so I read the story about Haridas Thakur, and I just had this burning desire for Tulsi beads. So Gorsinder and I went all over New York looking for where can we get Tulsi beads. And naturally, we went to an Indian store and got cheated. And the man said, oh, yes, yes, these are Tulsi. And we didn't know what Tulsi looked like. They were obviously redwood beads. Anybody could see they were redwood. They were hard, they were dark, they were brown, and they were about this big. They looked nothing like Tulsi. But because the Indian man told us they were Tulsi, we bought them. And then Prabhupada chanted on them. He looked at them and says, not Tulsi. But then he chanted on them anyway. And so then, so that was like a long time went by. And but I still had that desire, and he knew I had that desire. That's what's so wonderful, is you have spiritual desires that feel fulfilled. You know what I mean, Adiday? You do, he knows. Over the course of time, you'll have a spiritual desire that you don't tell anybody about. Prabhupada's the only one that knows about it, or Krishna in your heart. And somehow or other, it'll miraculously get fulfilled. So, when I got to Hawaii, This is a couple of years later. This is after we had traveled with Prabhupada from 67. We went to Hawaii in 1969. And I guess it was in sometime in the first year, we were living near the university. And the University of Hawaii had an incredible East-West Center that had excellent books. It had books by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. It had books by Bhaktisiddhanta. East-West Center means they would bring in all kinds of, not just from India, but from all parts of Asia. So I would go over there every evening and search through the stacks, because I like libraries, and I would find things for my husband, Gosundar, who was a scholar. And I would bring books to him. And one night, I stumbled on a book called Firminger's Gardening in India, which was written by a Britisher. It was in English. Although they were in English, too. And I read about Tulsi, and I had the botanical name. But always before, we didn't know what Tulsi was. So it's impossible to grow something if you don't know what it is and you've never seen it. But finding out that the botanical name was Osimum sanctum, a sister to Osimum basilicum, which is basil, aha, now I could figure out how to grow it. That's what I was thinking. So then I went to an Indian lady, and she was a very, she was an import lady. She went to India frequently. I begged her to get me some Tulsi seeds. And so she did. She brought me a little vial of seeds. Apparently they weren't viable because we planted them, and after a few weeks we were bowing down, worshiping a blade of grass. We don't know what it was, but it was just a shoot. And after a while we realized those weren't any good. So then the next time she went to India, I asked her to get me some seeds again, and this time the seeds worked. And these little heart-shaped seedlings popped up. And that's whenever the whole thing started, and we wrote Prabhupada, and he was very excited. He was very happy. He was extremely happy about it, actually. And so, years later, I was traveling with him in Mississippi. He was at the farm, and he gave a lecture. And in the course of the lecture, he mentioned something about Tulsi. And then he said, yes, Govindasi grew the Tulsi. I sent her the seeds. Oh, wait a minute now. And then it dawned on me. Yeah. For a second, I said, oh, but I got the seeds from an Indian lady. And I realized he did send me the seeds, because this is something that I had desired. I had desired very much. And, of course, then I went to L.A. He was in L.A., shortly thereafter, right after that. The plants were only about this big. And we got them through agriculture somehow. Actually, they stopped us at agriculture. You can't take any plants out of Hawaii. But they stopped us at agriculture. But then just as I was getting on the plane, one of the brahmacharis had a shoulder bag, and he just transferred it over to my shoulder. And inside were two little plants. And I took them to Prabhupada, and he was so happy. His servant told me that day, he must have talked for an hour about Tulsi, all about how Tulsi's husband was a demon and so many things, but he didn't go into the whole story. He stopped short. I think he thought that we weren't ready for that one. But no, really, he did. He stopped short. He didn't tell that story. And then his servant told me that he hadn't seen Prabhupada that happy in months, because that was right after all that political kushmakush took place in New Vrindavan, where the sannyasis did all this stuff, and I don't know, I didn't know anything about it. We were in Hawaii. We weren't up on what was going on mainland ISKCON at all. And so I had no idea. I thought he was always that happy. But he was telling me that no, he was like very, very unhappy with what was going on, and this was the first time he had seen him laugh and smile that much. So I was really very grateful that I got the opportunity to serve him in that way. I was very grateful. Whatever service we get is always grace. Was that a good enough answer for whoever asked it? Let's see. How did you avoid familiarity while serving Srila Prabhupada? I don't know what you mean by familiarity. I never forgot that he was my guru at any moment, any time. I don't quite understand. I don't know who asked the question, but it wasn't that hard to do. He was so far beyond me and anything else I had ever experienced. It was pretty easy, actually. I mean, he was completely exalted. There was one time I made the near fatal mistake of correcting something that he did. Even though I was well-intentioned, very well-intentioned, we were going to go and make a record album, and the album that has the materialistic demeanor cannot possibly stretch to the transcendental autocrat, it starts like that. You know what I'm talking about. Okay, so I typed it up, and he read it a couple of times because he was practicing. We were going to go in to the recording studio that day. So he was, huh? That's Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. It's in the Brahma Samhita. It's the part of the preface that his spiritual master wrote. And he wanted to speak that preface. Oh, okay. He wanted to speak that preface, and so I typed it up so that he could read it, so he could practice. So he read it two or three times, and I sat there and listened, and he practiced reading it. And it was very well-intentioned, I assure you. I had good intentions. I was just thinking, I kind of had a motherly attitude towards Srila Prabhupada because he actually was very ill that year. And so I was always having to be the bouncer and, you know, get people out so he didn't stay up too late. And because then he would say, oh, I have a headache the next day and stuff like that. So I was only thinking in terms that, you know, that he would put his best foot forward on this recording, because this is something that the whole world is going to hear. So I timidly said, Srila Prabhupada, I think that word is pronounced analogously. And he looked at me with fire, and he said, I'll pronounce it my way, and you pronounce it your way. Don't correct your guru. Don't correct anything he says or anything he writes, because it's an apparat. So I made an offense, but then he was very kind. But if you'll listen to that record album, you'll hear he says analogously. He pronounced it his way. Now, later I've heard that's a British pronunciation, but I don't actually know for a fact. I don't know. I just know I had always heard the word analogously. And so that was one mistake. You make mistakes. You burn the peanuts, or you do something stupid like that. You know, try to correct something that Prabhupada says or does. Or it's considered to be the worst kind of apparat to correct your guru. You just don't do that. It's like your guru is your superior. So that was one, I guess you might say, incident of familiarity. I guess we could say that was, in the sense that I stepped out of place by doing that. But it wasn't like he crucified me or anything. I just learned my lesson right off. I learned that you don't do that. So let me see what else is the next question here. Oh, this is the same thing, history of Panchatattva in Hawaii, history of Tulsi in Hawaii. Well, Panchatattva is a whole history. Actually, I wrote about the Panchatattva installation because it was kind of like an offering for our 40th anniversary a couple of years ago. And I wrote about how Prabhupada invited, how Prabhupada asked us to make the Panchatattva and how we invited him to come to install them and how the whole thing took place, that he told me to make them and I had no clue how to do it. And then, of course, I made a sculpture along with my friend Kusha. She helped me. And then I went over to the University of Hawaii and looking for somebody who knew how to make a mold. And I met a young man who was a grad student there named Louis Goldstein, who was extremely extremely opposed to any kind of icons. He later became a devotee. His name is Vishnu. But he was extremely anti-icon. But for some reason, working on Lord Chaitanya and getting prasadam changed him. And so he became a nice devotee. But it's anyway, I wrote about all this. It's on my website, Hare Krishna Hawaii, which tells about the history of the Panchatattva. It doesn't have all the stuff about deity worship. I need to do some more work on that. But it does have pretty much the history of it. Let's see. Why did Srila Prabhupada experience so much struggle and difficulty? For example, 2 heart attacks on the Jaladuta. God, I don't know how to answer that. Why? I have no idea how to answer that. I know that he was transcendental to all of it. I know that he had some wonderful experiences of Krishna guiding the boat. Sometimes devotees go through experiences that are not possible for us to understand, but we can't see them. Just like Prabhupada often gave the example of the governor visiting the prison. The governor comes to visit the prison doesn't mean he's not in the same situation as the prisoners. So I don't know really why. This is a hard one. What were Prabhupada's instructions on marriage? Did you see him perform a marriage ceremony, and what was it like? And was he particular about women covering their heads? Well, marriage, I could tell you that he married us. He married Gorsundar and I. And he also married a number of his other disciples. And he would always state that a sannyasi really has nothing to do with marriages, but I'm doing this for my students, for my disciples, so that they can make spiritual advancement. Because marriage is a purificatory ceremony, and for people to just live together without having this purificatory ceremony, they won't be able to make the kind of spiritual advancement they can. So with an actual marriage before the fire. So he, although Gorsundar and I were already together for about a year, we were going to college at the University of Texas, and we already considered ourselves married, Srila Prabhupada told us that he wanted to marry us, and he married us before the fire. And, of course, we all hope that these things last throughout our life, but unfortunately it seems that Westerners just have this topsy-turvy karma. Let's hope the youngsters do better. But it was a spiritualized thing in that what he did was he had a number of couples. He had Janaki and Mukunda, Shamsundar and Malati, and he had Gurudas and Jamuna, and he sent those three couples to England. He had Nandarani and Dayananda, and he sent them to L.A. Harsharani and Subal, and he sent them to Santa Fe. And, of course, Gorsinder and I, he sent us to Hawaii. So what Prabhupada's program was that he married these couples, and then he sent them to different cities to open centers, which is an ingenious plan because they brought the stability that was necessary to open a temple. There weren't any sannyasis at the time, and he didn't send brahmacharis to do it. He sent householder couples, and sometimes a brahmachari would come along. Like, we had one brahmachari who came along with us to Hawaii, Mahapurush. He was there for a while. But generally speaking, sannyasis are supposed to travel all the time, and brahmacharis don't have really a stable life. You know, they're moving about and so forth. And so that was Prabhupada's ingenious way of spreading Krishna consciousness all over, was with couples. And the idea of the marriage was because we were working together to serve Prabhupada. It was a very nice arrangement. And, I mean, it really was. I actually am very grateful for those years that I spent serving Prabhupada together with my husband, Gorsinder. And, of course, we all know that Shamsunder and Malati, and those three couples that went to England, they had a phenomenal success by making George Harrison a devotee. They had a band, a Hare Krishna band, rock band. They performed all over Europe, all over England. They were top 10 records. They were fantastically successful in their preaching program. And so that was, I guess that sort of answers it. Instructions on marriage, serve Krishna together. And yes, at the time that I joined, girls didn't wear saris. We really didn't even know what saris were. The only time I ever wore a sari was for my wedding, and Janaki wrapped me in this red silk thing that I had never seen before. So we weren't really, saris weren't in fashion yet. Prabhupada did really like for the ladies to wear saris. One really funny thing happened when he came back from India that first time in December in 67. December 14th, 1967. It was really funny. He was unpacking, all of us were sitting around, and he was unpacking his trunk and picking out all these far out things we'd never seen before. A coconut shredder that you put your knee on, you know, you know what I'm talking about. Things that we had never seen before. And then there was a whole stack of saris that someone had bought and pinned names on each sari. And he sat there and unpinned each one, put the pins in one stack, put the names in another stack, and then proceeded to give out the saris. It was very interesting. And then, of course, I didn't expect one because I hadn't even been living in San Francisco, but just as I was leaving, he said, Govindasi, have you taken your sari? I said, oh, there's one for me. And he handed me a lavender sari, which I wore until it became shreds, because when I was with him, serving him, I did wear saris, but covering the head wasn't, I mean, it's a nice thing to do in front of the deities, but it's not like we ever really talked about it that much. A lot of this stuff that came later is stuff that came later, you know. Prabhupada, he didn't really ever focus so much on the body consciousness thing. I don't know, it must be a symptom of Kali Yuga, because the whole society right now is completely gender conscious, you know. I'm a man, I'm gay, I'm a woman, I'm this, I'm a transvestite, I'm a lesbian. I mean, it's like all about gender. And it must be a symptom of Kali Yuga, because I don't remember it being like this when I was growing up. And being around Prabhupada, it was, you got whole organizations promoting one particular gender. So when we served Prabhupada in the early days, we weren't focused on the body, whatever body we had as a result of our karma. We were just focused outward on serving Prabhupada. We didn't think about, I can't do this or I can't do that. We did whatever had to be done. And that was the mood, I think, of the early days. And with Prabhupada, you felt like your spirit soul. You didn't feel like you were a body. You didn't think about, oh, I'm a woman, or I'm a man, or I'm a this, or I'm a that. You just served Prabhupada, and it was like you were identifying with the soul. And that is the idea. That's the philosophy. It's changed, and now people are so much into... But I think it must be a symptom of Kali, because it's just like I have my ID, I have my driver's license in my purse, but when I come to the temple, I don't come with my driver's license and say, okay, this is me, this is who I am. I come to the temple, and I'm here as spirit soul. I approach Prabhupada, I approach the deities as a soul, and I don't flash my ID, because that's just my bodily ID. So, just like a doctor, he comes to the temple, and when he's in the temple, he's not a doctor, he's just spirit soul. And then when he leaves the temple, he goes to his office, and he puts on his doctor jacket, and he's able to do that, you know. But so basically, this is a... something that's happened since, I guess it started happening while Prabhupada is still present, where there's this newfound attitude of I'm this. But it wasn't so much so. Generally, we didn't think like that. It was like if you talk to any older devotees, they'll tell you, we were just so busy doing whatever we could to spread the mission that we weren't thinking about what particular body we had. We were working together. I mean, like whenever they were preaching to George Harrison, Janaki and Jamuna were in the kitchen baking apple pies with an apple carved out on them. And then Shamsundar was, you know, trying to get in the door to see George Harrison. It was called a group effort. It was everybody worked together. It wasn't like, well, Prabhu, I'm a man and you can't do that, or Prabhu, you're a woman and I'm a woman. It just didn't exist. It wasn't, it had not yet been discovered. And I think it must be a part of the whole society, because gender consciousness is really, really dominant now in America. I don't know, maybe everywhere, but Prabhupada just, his main mood was that you don't have much time. Whatever talents you have, whatever little bit of time you have in this body, you do something for Krishna. Don't wait. This was his mood. He didn't even like if somebody decided, well, I'm going to go to school for 6 months and learn how to do this so I can do this service. No, just do it. That was his mood. And the reason is because he saw that the house is burning down. He saw what we don't see is how fast time is moving us toward death. It's very quick. And so his mood was, do something for Krishna right now, immediately. Don't wait. And don't take into consideration whether or not you can do it. Just try. I mean, in San Francisco, when he first got back from India, Gursinder and I were studying Sanskrit. Every day he was giving us Sanskrit and Bengali lessons, and we would sit in the room and he would speak the alphabet and we would write it down, and then we would repeat it, and he would teach us certain verses. He taught one particular verse that he would always ask me to chant that verse for him, because he really liked to see us trying to learn. And we were sitting in the kitchen table in the evening, one evening in L.A., and we were writing our Gursinder and I were writing our alphabets, you know, the Devanagari. And Prabhupada came in and looked over our shoulder. He looked at it for a little bit, and then he said something like, so the Krishna is seeing you're trying. Even the teacher sees you're making some scribbles. He sees that the student is trying. And then he said, Krishna doesn't need anything from us. He doesn't need anything at all. All he wants is our love. So that was more the mood that, and of course, I think his mood also was, which is the example he set, that I, Hari Hari Bifale, the song Hari Hari Bifale, was his favorite song. He would sing that in the morning with a harmonium, and tears would just flow down his face. And that song basically says, my Lord, I've wasted my life. I've drank poison by not worshiping you. I've simply wasted my life in this way and that way. And I've simply drunk poison. And so that was his mood. That was the mood that he had and that he shared for us to understand that our mood should be, we've wasted our lives. We must try to worship Radha and Krishna. We must try to be devotees with what little bit of time we have left. Anyway, it's 8 o'clock. I don't want to take it. I think I answered all the questions, didn't I? Did I? Can't hear you. I'm very hard of hearing. It's due to an airline flight. It's not just due to old age, but of course, old age is part of it.
Did you want to stop now, or did you want to go until
Well, isn't it supposed to stop at 8?
Not necessarily. Arctic at 8:50.
Okay. Well, is there any more questions? I've tried to answer these. I think I've answered all of them to the best of my ability. If I can hear how.
Hare Krishna. I'm very grateful to hear all these beautiful pastimes. I was wanting to ask if you know of any oral history project happening of asking to... I was wanting to know if you've heard of or know of any effort to document the history of the movement from devotees like yourself who've been there. We've seen it. Is there any like oral history project going of taking down?
Write about things. Is that what you mean?
I've heard of people writing books, but I'm thinking that I would like to be able to help either participate with or hear more about the stories of the history of the movement, because you're speaking about events as if people understood about them, but I never heard of them, like the Puri speech, for example.
Well, I think all the devotees are working. I know Shamsundar is working on a book right now, and he says it's flowing very nicely, and I think Jamuna just had something come out. I haven't seen it yet, but my girlfriend Kusha tells me it's wonderful. She's got it in India. And I think Brahmananda has also written something, and I haven't got it yet, but I hope to get it soon. So I think it is important for all these old disciples, before they kick the bucket, they should write about all these things. You know, I'm trying to write about it. I've got some things written. it is important because things have changed so much. They've morphed into different directions since Prabhupada left, and it's just natural because it's not an easy thing when you think about it to take this and superimpose it on Western culture. It's been a very challenge. And one thing that's of great significance is that very much toward the end of Srila Prabhupada's life, when he was in Bhubaneswar and he was in Puri and that at that time, he was ready to take the movement into a different direction toward Varnashram, because he felt, I mean, you can read, there's lots of conversations and lots of material on this, that he had focused on making Brahmins and sannyasins and the Brahminical class But the problem was it wasn't working. The sannyasis were falling down right and left. And so his mood was he wants to help the whole world, not just a segment of people. And so he was saying that better to take this in the direction of Varna Ashram, where people work according to their natural inclination, whatever that is, and dedicate their work to Krishna, which is in the Gita, rather than just focusing on having a brahminical class. And for this, he was encouraging farm communities. And some people are very good with driving oxen, and some people are very good with, different occupational inclinations, rather than trying to make everybody into a Brahmin. You have to have some Brahmins for the deity worship, and you have to have some sadhana, and you have to have the chanting. He wasn't saying not do that. He was trying to explain this, and I've read over these conversations several times, and I would encourage anyone to do so. Read what he had to say toward the end of his life, which was, we're talking about October, we're talking about, in Bhubaneswar, he was talking about it when we were there in Bhubaneswar. There is a farm in Bhubaneswar. And he said one very wonderful thing. It was really amazing. He was sitting out by his little mud hut. He loved those little cow dung huts. And he was saying that, you see, now all of these bushes, they're very small. But in due course of time, they will grow into be big trees. And then they will bear fruit. And then he said, and then, then you shall see what is this movement of Lord Chaitanya. And for me, it was kind of a glimpse of the future, that right now things are just little bushes, but they're going to become incredible in the future. So he was trying to take things in the direction of Varnashram toward the end. And if his, in fact, he even said something like, I had wanted to introduce Varnashram. And I can't say that I completely understand it, but I sort of understand it after reading over the conversations several times, that he was frustrated with the direction that the movement was going. It hadn't worked so well because people weren't able to maintain. They were able to maintain for a little while, but Westerners especially couldn't continue with the rigid kind of standards, and the sannyas became a kind of a perversion or a social disruption. And actually, a lot of scriptures even say that in the age of Kali, sannyas is not recommended because it can be a social disruption. We've seen what's happened, you know. At the same time, why did Prabhupada give so many sannyasis sannyas? Prabhupada needed to spread the movement very quickly all over the world. And so for doing that, this was the agency that he used. I mean, he sent one sannyasi, Madhuvisa, down to Australia, and he opened up all of Australia and New Zealand. He sent, because by taking that vow, even if one doesn't keep it later on, by taking that vow, one gets great spiritual power. And so the house was burning down. He didn't have much time. He had to spread very quickly. But at the same time, most of the sannyasis were not able to maintain it, and therefore he was thinking, don't get the idea that he was like, ugh, disgusting. He wasn't. As soon as he heard that Madhuvisa was in Hawaii, he immediately sent him a telegram. He immediately sent Rameshwar to go get him. He loved each one of his disciples. It wasn't like he he rejected them or anything like that. But the point is that most of the Westerners haven't been raised in such a way, in a culture that was conducive to maintaining that kind of rigorous, lifestyle. So Prabhupada was looking for a way to help all of humanity. He wanted to help all of human society. And that's what he was moving toward, Varna Ashram, which is that everyone work according to their ability. They don't have to be Brahmins. They don't have to be big, important people. But they dedicate their work to Krishna, which is one of the recommendations in the Bhagavad Gita, as we know. So that's something that was very significant and that I've actually been studying just recently. And also, toward the end, like I said, at the Kumbh Mela, Prabhupada was yelling at the sannyasis. He was very unhappy with them. And so he was trying to find a way to... He said no more sannyas, you know that, before he left. He wouldn't... No amount of money, I will not give any more sannyas. But he said, let's do it a different way. A varna, let the people work according to their abilities and dedicate that work to Krishna. And and so that's the direction that he was going at that time, and the direction that you youngsters are going to have to take it, because we're getting too old. I know we're just one foot in the grave here. So the young people are going to have to take it in that direction in order to... And then, Prabhupada predicted the money crash, the fact that the money would become worthless, the printing of the money constantly, how it becomes devalued. He predicted that, and of course the also talked about the fact that this oil society is going to end. And I mean, back then, you have to realize, we're talking about 1967, 68, 69. Nobody thought the party would ever end in those days. There weren't any activists yet. But Prabhupada could foresee all of this very clearly, that this culture that we're living in, the oil-based culture with printed money and so forth, is on a limited timeline. And that's why he started telling the devotees, get farms, get self-sufficient, this is not going to last, your cities are going to collapse, they're going to turn into hell holes. And, it already is happening to some extent, but there could be more. And of course he talked about the atomic weapons. He talked about all these things way, way in advance. He could foresee how the whole world was moving. We're like just ignorantly born into it and living it, but he could see it from a higher perspective. And his mood wasn't... He didn't want to create a hierarchical religion like the Catholic Church with bishops and all this. He wanted to create a whole cultural movement that would help everyone throughout the world to see a different way of life, to see another lifestyle that could put God in the center, put Krishna in the center, and also be happy, self-sustaining and so forth. This was his, toward the end of his life, these are the things that he was talking about quite a lot. And those things have kind of, I guess they've kind of gotten a little bit lost. Not terribly lost. There's still some, the farms kind of got neglected for a while. I'm not really sure why. But some of them got sold and some of them got neglected. But actually, that was the direction he was moving. And now I think it's time to play catch up really fast, because there probably isn't that much longer that this society is going to be moving at such an even keel. Because, now you can read anywhere that they're printing money as fast as they can. The government is. And we know all about the national debt, and we know about all this stuff. And none of this existed at that time. So much for the politics. So thank you very much for tolerating my Hare Krishna. Oh, wait, there's one more thing. What were Prabhupada's favorite and dear to his heart projects? Fate Museum. And we have with us Adi Dave. And this is the person who studied in India along with Bard Raj and his wife Srila Ditya. That Fate Museum was Prabhupada's baby. He wanted more of these dioramas, these doll museums. That and the drama troops that would travel around. And he actually asked Gaurisundara to do a Fate Museum also at one meeting that he had with him. He wanted many of these dioramas, and that's another thing that has fallen by the wayside that you guys can take up, because they're doing it in India. The Bengalis are very good at it, you know. So that's, Adi Dave can tell you all about you should write about the fate, you should speak about it. People don't even know what that is anymore. And it was so dear to Srila Prabhupada's heart. He loved it. He was delighted when he would see these exhibits. Anyway, thank you very much. Hare Krishna.